compassion training. There's several hosts to this show, including Tamara Wichma, Sky Lee, Jonah Richmond, Adam Mose. But today, I'll be your host. This is Catherine Chapman joining you here at the 5 o'clock hour. Going to get you started with a new rendition of a song that I've been pretty tickled about. This is I Believe in a Thing Called Love.
Can't explain all the ways that you're making me feel. My heart's in overdrive and you're behind the steering wheel. Touching you, you. Touching me. Touching you, touching me. Oh, I believe in a thing called love. Listen to the rhythm of my heart. There's a chance we can make it now. We'll be rocking till the sun goes down. I believe in a thing called love. Oh, 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 hey. I wanna kiss you every minute of every hour of every day. But baby, everything is A-okay.
Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by one of Chico's newest restaurants, Rallo's West at 234 West 33rd Street in the heart of downtown. Rallo's West offers small and large plates, Maryland-style shrimp, blue crab cakes, a wine bar, charcuterie, and artisanal cheeses. Rallo's West is open from 5 till 9 p.m. until 10 on Friday and Saturday. For more information, visit them on Facebook or by calling 636-4468.
I believe anything called love. This sound of the rhythm of my heart. There's a chance we can make it now. We'll be rocking till the sun goes down. I believe in a thing called love, 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 love. Oh, I believe in a thing called love. This sound of the rhythm of my heart. There's a chance we can make it now. We'll be rocking till the sun goes down. I believe in a thing called love.
All right, you are tuned into Love in the 21st Century on 90.1 KZFR. This is Kat Chapman joining you. And actually, I'm feeling a little bit under the weather today, folks. So as a nice little compromise, I've decided to just share some teachings from a man that has been giving me great insight in my life. Goes by the name of Ram Dass. Born the name Richard Alpert, but after doing some work and journeying in India and work with the Hindu guru Neem Karoli Baba, he was given the name Ram Dass. You might be familiar with his 1971 book, Be Here Now, and his work back in the 60s with Timothy Leary and Harvard University. But I've got a little excerpt from one of his talks about awakening and relationships. And as I'm finishing up our 5-week series on relationships, I thought he might have some nice insights for us. He actually currently resides in Maui, and frankly, that's where Tamara Wichma is right now. So a little shout out to Tamara, the founder of this show, while she's there on the islands, and who knows, maybe she'll run into Ram Dass. If you are liking the teachings that you hear and want to hear more, you can always find out more at ramdass.org. So here we go with this nice excerpt. I hope that it is a nice cool down here on this warm Chico afternoon. And it seems that I'm having
some
trouble.
A boatman is rowing on a misty lake. The fog is thick. Suddenly he bumps another boat. He starts to scream profanities at the other boatman for not looking where he was going. The fog clears for a moment and he looks at the other boat and sees that it's empty. That's really the essence of the lecture on relationships. All those things we're getting angry at and we are fascinated by, they are all just things happening. We keep identifying them with people. That's channel 6. There are three terms in Buddhism that are focused on a great deal. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. The anicca we've talked about already. It means change. Everything's changing all the time. All forms are in a state of change, transformation, all the time. So there's nowhere you can grab hold and be sure it's going to be that way. Remember that poem called Ozymandias about a great king? Built a big empire. And the poet is crossing the desert and he comes upon a piece of stone sticking out of the sand. Just one piece of stone. And there's an inscription on it. And he translates it. And it says, I am Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing more remained. All change. And this too shall pass. It was the king who was going to wipe out a group of people, minority group. The wise man of the minority group came to him and said, King, save us, save us. And he said, well, If by sunrise you can give me something which every time I'm sad will make me happy, I'll spare your lives. The wise men went into council and they thought and thought, and finally they prepared a ring. In the morning they came and they presented the ring to the king, and the king said, "How will this ring make me happy when I'm sad?" And they said, "Oh, sire, read the inscription in the ring." The inscription in the ring was, "And this too shall pass." Every time he's sad, that too shall pass, and that made him happy. He hadn't yet noticed that it works the other way around, too. It's all changing. It's all changing. The second of those three things is dukkha, which means suffering. Which means all form is limited. All form isn't infinite, it's finite. It's always contained or controlled. It's always pushing back into the formless, into the all. And any attachment to those forms is suffering. If you identify with the form, you will suffer. Because the form is changing, and the form is bound. That's dukkha. And the third of those three things, anicca, dukkha, anatta, means that there is no self. There's no separate entity. There is no soul. That all is changing. It's just patterns of changing things. And in them there may be the illusion of a separate entity, of a me or of an I. But it's just a dream. Anatta, no self. You see, what I've been talking about yesterday had to do with Channel 4, with the concept of soul, or an entity that reincarnates. But if you stop at that level of identifying yourself as a soul, there's still going to be suffering. Because a soul, no matter how subtle it is still something. And as long as you see yourself as something, you are separate from all the rest of it. So there's not even a one. Because if you're two, if you're a little particle and you're going back into the source and you say, "There's the one," you're saying there's the one from outside of it, which means the two. And as you go into the one, there's no more counting. There's no one, there's no zero. To say that is empty is fallacious. To say that that is full is fallacious. Because any time you describe it or discriminate or label it, you're back in the two again. From within the one, there are no labels, there's no description, there's no way to conceive of yourself or of what is or isn't. And it's interesting that nuclear physicists like Oppenheimer, you know, Nobel Prize winning physicist, says about the smallest unit of energy in the universe. Says you can't exactly say that it exists. You can't exactly say that it doesn't exist. It's just that fine line between form and formless. So that you and I are using different systems, and I just think if we're clear about the systems, it's very useful. This is known as Jnana Yoga, of using the mind to see through the mind. If you see that you use the soul to extricate your identification with the soul, to extricate yourself from identification with your personality and with your body. But then, as Ramakrishna says, you take a thorn to take another thorn out of your foot, and then you throw both thorns away. So that ultimately the concept of soul, which helped free you from an identification with a personality, that itself must go too. So that if you're going to experience how you actually are, you are constantly surrendering every definition and every form into the emptiness. And all these words like saying, it just is, or I am, are just fingers pointing at the moon. They're not the moon. Because when you dwell where you stand nowhere, there's nobody in the boat. Now, most people are very attached to eternality. They want something of themselves to continue, their awareness, their consciousness. They don't want that little break in consciousness. So they want to know that the soul survives. When I asked Emmanuel about how upset people got when I said, you go back into nothing, I said, they wanted to keep their separateness. He said, oh, you humans with your dualistic minds. It's great. Only dolphins and, disembodied beings can say, oh, you humans. I mean, I've never talked to anybody that said, oh, you humans before. Oh, you humans and your dualistic minds. Why do you think you can't be the one and the many at the same moment? See, and to see that the nothing contains the everything and the everything is the many, you see that from inside there is no definition and from outside there's the many. And you are and you aren't. Can you handle that? Can you handle that you are and you aren't? It's such a subtle part of awareness to keep merging into itself and coming back into form, and merging into itself and coming back into form. So that you see everything, thing, every body, every personality, every astral identity, every soul, every subtle essence, thing, is going back into nothing. And then out of the nothing comes the form again. It's like dealing with a space between two thoughts. It's going from the thought into the space between the thought. Between. And each thought has its creation, its existence, its destruction, and then space. Creation, existence, destruction, space. And the space between those thoughts. Well, the thoughts go by at the rate of about 1 trillion per blink of an eye. And there's a space between every one of them. And your awareness, as long as you identify it with thoughts, is limited by the rate at which thoughts can go by in a linear fashion, which is a physical thing. It's a chemical action. But your awareness isn't so limited. And by the discipline of extricating the awareness from identification with the thoughts, Buddha was able to see each thought. He stood outside of time and he saw each thought come into existence, exist, and pass away. And he described the last 32 thoughts before he went into the space between two thoughts. I mean, that makes science fiction look like Tinker Toys, if you can play with that, if that isn't too much for you. That's called Nibbana, the space between the thoughts, the discontinuity of consciousness. So in a way, when we talk about spaciousness, that's we're talking a way in which you are everything and you are nothing. And you rest in that place. And then you come back down into forms and you function in the forms impeccably. You're a perfect soul, you're a perfect personality, you're a perfect body. And your perfection, you're more perfect in your role the more you are resting nowhere. Now, when we come to relationship, you've got to see the relationship is between two things. No matter how subtle those things are, souls, that's relationship. But who you are has no relationship at one level, because how does the one relate? So that you see that what you are with another person is both separate and not separate. What would it be like if that were real for you all the time? Is this, can anybody hear this? You hear what I'm saying, or is this too heavy, or what? Huh? Yeah. Anybody here? See, most of us, because of our human hearts, we want to come down where it's sweet, where we're separate entities and there's relationship, because relationship is where all the drama is. It's where all the romance is. It's where all the coming and going is. It's where the storyline is. It's where the trip is. It's where the rush is. It's where the, can you hear all that? Listen to this and see how sweet it feels.
The one. Here's the one.
This is from the I Ching. The master said, "Life leads the thoughtful man on a path of many windings. Now the course is checked. Now it runs straight again. Here winged thoughts may pour freely forth in words, but there the heavy burden of knowledge must be shut away in silence. But when two people are at one in their inmost hearts, they shatter even the strength of iron or bronze. And when two people understand each other in their inmost hearts, their words are sweet and strong, like the fragrance of orchids." You can see that as two beings get close to one another, and don't get lost in the bodies, and don't get lost in the personalities, and the needs, the desires, the fears, the paranoia, and can get through, and they can meet as souls. They are getting very close to being an identity. Being the one, and yet the two. It's the moment between formless and form. It's that space. It's an intimacy that is complete because it's an identity. Now, as long as you're in your body, you can't do that, because bodies, as Ramana Maharshi said, what can bodies do but rub against each other? Gross though that might seem for something so sweet. personalities can relate as objects. Souls can look at something, the personality and the body from outside. They can start to go in and out of one another, but they're still unique. But at some moments they come together, and then there's neither one nor two nor anything, and there's everything. And it doesn't matter which relationship we're talking about. Whether we're talking about the policeman, or the lover, or the child, or the employer, or the enemy, or the opponent. We keep getting lost in the forms, in the labels, in who we think we're seeing and who we think we're relating to. We keep getting lost in the labels and in what our senses tell us and our thinking minds discriminate. And we fail to see through that veil. See that there's another soul, and then to merge into the one. Let's imagine for a moment that you could do that. That you as an individual had so little attachment to your own separateness that you could be in the world but not of the world. You could be separate and yet not separate. So that you were always right here, beyond form and also in form. Now you meet another person. Because there's part of you resting in your totality, where is your need? Where is your desire? Where is it that you need something from that other person? So at that moment, when you are resting deeply in your isness, since you don't need anything from the other person, even the subtlest thing, you don't even need them to keep from killing you. Because you don't need anything. You just are here. And if you talk about consciousness, you say you are here. If you talk about love, you would say you are unconditionally loving. You're in love with another person, and you have no conditions. There's no way you have to be for me to love you. I just love you, because I am you. And the place where there's only one of us is the same word as love. One of the words we use to point at it is love. Meher Baba said, love has to spring spontaneously from within. It is in no way amenable to any form of inner or outer force. Love and coercion can never go together. Love can never be forced on anyone. It can be awakened in her or him through love itself. Love is essentially self-communicative. Those who do not have it catch it from those who have it. True love is unconquerable and irresistible. And it goes on gathering power and spreading itself until eventually it transforms everyone whom it touches. It's the story of the invading army that was invading a country, a Buddhist country, and they were disemboweling the Buddhist monks. They arrived in this country, and a particularly cruel officer whose reputation had spread far and wide came into a village, and he said to his adjutant, "Give me a report about the village." And the adjutant said, "All of the people are afraid of you, and they're doing obeisance to you, and the monks in the local monastery have all fled to the mountains, except for one monk." The officer was furious at the thought of this monk who was not afraid of him. So he walked to the monastery, and he pushed open the gates of the monastery. And there in the middle of the courtyard was the monk. And he walked up to the monk, and he said, "Don't you know who I am? I could take my sword, and I could run it through your belly without blinking an eye." "And don't you know who I am?" said the monk. "I could have your sword run through my belly without blinking an eye." That's what I mean by resting in a part of yourself that is not identified, even with your body. So where is the vulnerability? No vulnerability. You can afford to love unconditionally the entire universe. It's the universe loving itself. So when they say that the guru loves unconditionally, that's what we're talking about. Talking about the one loving itself. Now, in our relationships with one another, many of the relationships you keep very much on the physical and psychological plane. They're functional and efficient. The fellow at the gas station pumps gas. The bank teller exchanges money. And you keep it all at that level of role and body. And very rarely do you acknowledge that there are any other levels to those relationships. You keep them that way. Then people look for another kind of relationship. They look for a relationship in which they can experience their soul. Where they can experience even beyond that, where they can experience what they call love. In other words, they would like to use their relationship with another person as a vehicle to bring them into that place of oneness, of peace, of isness, of love, of consciousness. And you see how exquisite the whole design of the game is that attraction, sexual attraction, which leads to reproduction, is one of the things that aligns people to allow them to come into that space of transcendence. And the moment of orgasm is a moment of transcendence. So that the game is designed so that that yearning to come back into the one is what facilitates the reproduction of the species. But momentarily. Even if you're a tantric, you can spread it out for an hour. But that's about it. So people meet somebody, and because of some set of compatible, symbiotic, complementary characteristics, they are attracted to each other. And through a certain, because of that alignment, It's as if that's the chemical release mechanism that allows them to open to the part of themselves that has no form. And they say, I am in love. I am experiencing love. But as we said before, methods are traps. And you keep identifying your method with where it brings you. So you end up, instead of saying, I am in love, you say, I am in love with you. It's like if you're a meditator, you say, I am in love with meditation. Because meditation brings me into the place of love. So I am in love with you. And because I identify you with the method of how I get into the place of love, because I can't get there on my own, and you're a method that's built into the system, it's kind of, because I'm a part of a species, I want to possess you, because you're my connection. And I want to know where you're going to be next Thursday at 2. And I want to collect you. And I say, come on, let's build a nest. And I collect twigs. But now you are experiencing that oneness, but you're experiencing it via a form. And you know somewhere in your being that all forms change. So the whole thing is doomed right at the beginning. And there's fear in that, because you know that sooner or later something changes. No matter how good you are at trying to plan against it, like Ozymandias, it's all going to change. And that's what makes romantic poetry so poignantly beautiful, because it always has in it the pain and the fear and the inevitability of change, of death, of transformation, of falling away, of attachment, of all that stuff. For some of us, our rush is just from that kind of romantic, bittersweet quality of a relationship. The horrible beauty, is that the word for it? Horrible beauty. Horrible beauty. Such a fine line of love and hate. Love and fear. But sometimes, after you have started to awaken and you are resting in your being more and more, you're not walking around as a needful entity looking to lock in so quickly, even though the needs are still there because you are part of a species, but you're not so long identified with that. The mechanism still works to line you up with another being, but you're already resting in the place of love. So now you experience the sharing of love with another person, the sharing of the oneness, but it's without fear. Because you don't need that other person to be in it. You are already in it. It's entirely different. It's entirely different. Because as long as you need the other person for you to feel what it means to be in love, you are vulnerable, you are off balance, you are frightened, you are grabbing and grasping and angry and having models of how the other person should be, and you are creating suffering all the time. It's built into the card. The minute your love comes out of love, whole different ballgame. Coming, going, also. But it's complicated for those of us humans that have come through personalities and deprivation models. You meet somebody, you are resting in love, and you meet somebody, and you feel that love with them. You feel like you've just, the two of you have just come into oneness together. And it's extremely sweet. It's like lining up on planes. You're already in channel 6, but now you're also lining it up in channel 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And your old model of yourself as somebody who needs something, the deprivation model says, let's build a nest, and you get your twigs and do your thing. And then after a while, you say, well, I'm going to the supermarket to get tofu and yogurt. And you're at the checkout counter, and you look into the eyes of the person at the checkout counter. And there it is again. Because you're in love. And everyone you look at is your beloved, more or less, unless there's some reason you're seeing them as, you're not my beloved. But as you're resting in the place of love, you see love. You just start to see it. And some other people rise to it too. And so you meet this person at the checkout counter, and you still are functioning under your old deprivation model. So you say, have you considered a ménage à trois? Because I may go home and the one in the nest may not be there. So I'll collect you too. From here on, it gets complicated. Politically and economically. Socially. Because from now on, you better not look in anybody's eyes. Because it's going to get just more and more complicated. As some of you have found out. Because you start to love everybody you see. And as long as you're working on the deprivation model, you want to collect each one. At least get their telephone number for later in case. Sort of a security. And it takes a long time to shift gears enough to be able to give up the deprivation model, to just rest in what is and not want anything and not feel you're going to need it later, and be able to walk by somebody and look at them and love them immensely and not collect them, not even grab at them, not even do a let's have coffee or a I love you, or even the eyes opening. You just walk by and you look at your beloved and you walk right on. Then in that quietness, you can begin to hear who it is you're to be with for what reason. It's amazing how the nature of your relationships change when it's coming out of love instead of trying to get love. As long as I am one that needs love, I have to look into all of your eyes to say, am I doing enough so that you will love me? If I'm just resting in my being, I'm listening and I'm manifesting, and you either love me or don't love me. That's your work. And you will open as you will open. And I want to tell you that as a yoga, it's a stinker. In fact, if you have a choice, use any other yoga but the yoga of relationship. Because it's one of the hardest yogas to use. Because it's working with reproduction and survival and a whole lot of things that make it almost impossible to stay awake in it. Pride, righteousness, all that stuff. Freedom of space and time and things like that. The third one of relationship is where two people are resting in the one and then they just play at the game of two. It's God at play as two. People are so rooted in their shared awareness and to fulfill the form of the formless, to just manifest impeccably, they are the two and they dance together. The lila, the play. They're no longer caught in the struggle between each other. They're resting in their oneness, and they're dancing at the two. But the dance includes jealousy, anger, love, passion, boredom, disgust, loathing, sweetness, tenderness, everything. It's all there. That's part of the passion play. It's part of what goes on in the forms. And remember, you are in the world, but not of the world. So it doesn't mean all that stuff isn't there. It's all there. You're in the world. And it's real, and yet it isn't real. And sometimes two people are locked in, I hate your guts, you... And they can just barely look across at each other. You here? I'm here. We'll never get through this one. And then back into it. It's like the level at which people play tennis together. You compete in a tennis game. You try to beat the other guy. At the same moment, you both collaborated to come on the tennis court. So you are both collaborators and competitors. And what we call a bad sport is somebody who forgets that. Good sports are good losers or good winners because they understand it's a collaboration. But a bad sport is somebody who forgets it's a collaboration or is so collaborative, forgets it's a competition and gives away the game. That's not a good sport either. Good sport has to play hard and yet remember that it's a game. Now, the yoga of relationship, the second one, is where two people come together and they say, we would like to come together in order to find God, to be in God, to be with God, to be beyond God. Takes care of the personalists and the impersonalists. Nowhere to stand, my love. A relationship that deals with truth walks the fine line between cosmos and chaos all the time. Because what is truth between two beings that even in our gross system are at least six planes? That's at least 12 people right there. So how can you have so much consistency? One moment, one of them is there in their body and they're feeling desire, and the other one is in the soul and feeling spacious. What do you do then? That's the one that comes to me and says, I just want God and my husband just wants to go to bed all the time. Should I leave him? Now, the issue of leaving and staying with people is an interesting one in our culture. See, there are other cultures which have rules like in the old traditional India, a couple came together and they were betrothed and till death do us part, and the partner went on the funeral pyre when the other one died. That's pretty much out of date these days. But still, in a village I've lived in India, The marriages are arranged by the astrologer, and the couple marries wearing masks of Krishna and Radha, and they don't even see each other till after the marriage. And they're going to stay together for life. Some of you shudder at that thought, what it's like when the mask comes off. We can make a distinction in relationships between what we call given and acquired karma. That's a word, these are terms I use. I don't know whether they're traditional terms at all. Given karma is like my father. I can't trade him in. Well, Dad, you're not conscious enough. See you later. I'm going to get a more conscious father to work with. You know, you can't really do that. Can't do with your children, you can't do with your aunts and uncles. I mean, they're given karma. That's what you got this round. You created that from a soul's point of view for some work you got to do, and it's one you're not going to be able to walk away from. You can try to walk away from by getting distance, but those of you that put distance between you and someone else because of some attachment, either hatred or love, know that you, what is the distance? It's still going on in your head anyway. Then there is acquired karma. That's where you are friends with someone because you're both in the bowling club. And then you stop bowling and your involvement with that person falls away. Because it was situational that you had a friendship or that you were with somebody. Where do marriages fit into that? Are they given or acquired? See, historically, they were treated as you made a contract that made that relationship a given. You said it's like my father or mother or kids. I can't trade it in. But at this moment in California, 52% of the marriages end in divorce and 80% of the divorcees remarry. So what you have is serial monogamy. That's what you have. I mean, technically, an anthropologist would say that is a serially monogamous culture. No matter, you can impose your value judgments, that's values, but in terms of just the actuarial data, that's what you got. So it appears that we are moving towards treating marriage as an acquired rather than a given. You work with a person as long as it feels useful, and then you go on and you say, see you later, and you end up and you say, we ended up perfect friends. We have both agreed, serial monogamy. Now, you have both kinds of relationships in your life, just like I do. And you can see the advantages and disadvantages of both. And you and I are in a culture where there's so much ambiguity about this issue that that ambiguity awakens you to the nature of this kind of issue. It's an interesting position to be in, where you were in a culture where everybody did one thing or everybody did another. You wouldn't be awake and you just automatically do it. But the fact that you have to constantly decide whether you're going to or not, each time it gets nitty-gritty, are you going to split or are you going to go deeper? Because nitty-gritty means you lock into a place where your pride and your righteousness and your models are in conflict. The other person, but surrender to the one that lies behind the two again. Surrender to that part of you.
All righty. Thank you all for tuning in. This is Love in the 21st Century. This is Kat Chapman. We're a talk show, but I appreciate you going on this little journey with me, with Ram Dass, talking about awakening and relationships. If you're in Hawaii and has a website, ramdass.org, Ishings. Special thanks today to Steve Chudy. He's been in here helping me run the board, and he'll be joined by his wife Susan, and they're going to take over for the next hour with Ecotopia, so tune in for that. And this is wrapping it up with our 5 weeks. We're going to, between the hosts, Adam Mose, Jonah Richman, Sky Lee, and Tamara Wichma, we're going to be going over love and community starting next week, the same time with Tamara. So in light of all the aloha around with Ram Dass from Maui and Tamara, shout out to you again out there in the island. I'm going to play a song here by Brudda Is called Sea of Love, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
So come with much I love you. Yes, I do.
So long, Don. It's been god-awful to know you. Don Blankenship, who was the king of King Cole, is headed toward a place he never imagined he'd end up. Federal prison. The ruthless CEO of Massey Energy Corporation arrogantly assumed he was above the law. So for years, he openly disdained the safety rules of his dangerous industry, willfully violating them in order to increase corporate profits. When the law caught up with Blankenship, forcing him to resign as Massey CEO in 2010, he awarded himself a $12 million golden parachute to cushion his fall. All of his enrichment, however, was blood money. Literally, the unpleasant fact of corporate profiteering is that greed kills. In 2010, workers caused a furious explosion to rip through its Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia. 29 miners were instantly blown to bits. The worst U.S. mine disaster result of Blankenship's deliberate disregard of deadly buildup, refusal to maintain detectors and sprays to prevent explosions. This game is about money, he preached relentlessly to his mine managers, demanding safety shortcuts to enhance profits. He racked up thousands of safety citations, viewing the puny fines as the cheap cost of rich profits. Workers be damned. This is Jim Hite. Convicted last year of conspiring to violate mine safety standards, Blankenship was sentenced in April to a year in prison. Yes, that's not much to pay for 29 deaths, but no murderous Appalachian coal executive has ever been put behind bars for even a day. To follow his future, A.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart? You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And KCFR Chico, listener-supported community radio. Up next, Ecotopia.
With a pink hotel, a boutique, don't it always seem to go that you'd rise, put up a parking lot.